purport. It is sometimes misunderstood that a grihastha, a householder, is permitted to indulge in sex at any time. This is a wrong conception of grihastha life. In spiritual life, whether one is a grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyasi, or brahmachari, everyone is under the control of the spiritual master. For brahmacharis and sannyasis, there are strong restrictions on sexual indulgence. Similarly, there are strong restrictions for grihasthas. Grihasthas should engage in sex life only in accordance with the order of the guru. Therefore, it is mentioned here that one must follow the orders of the spiritual master, Guru Vrittir Vikalpena. When the spiritual master orders, the grihastha may accept sex life. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita 7.11. Dharma virudu bhuti shukamosmi. Indulgence in sex life without disobedience to the religious rules and regulations constitutes a religious principle. The grihastha is allowed to indulge in sex life during the period favorable for procreation and in accordance with the spiritual master's order. If the spiritual master's orders allow a grihastha to engage in sex life at a particular time, then the grihastha may do so. Otherwise, if the spiritual master orders against it, the grihastha should abstain. The grihastha must obtain permission from the spiritual master to observe the ritualistic ceremony of Garbhadham Samskara. Then he may approach his wife to beget children, otherwise not. A Brahmin generally remains a brahmachari throughout his entire life. A brahmana generally remains a brahmachari throughout his entire life, but although some brahmanas become grihasthas and indulge in sex life, they do so under the complete control of the spiritual master. The kshatriya is allowed to marry more than one wife, but this also must be in accordance with the instructions of the spiritual master. It is not that because one is a grihastha, he may marry as many times as he likes and indulge in sex life as he likes. This is not spiritual life. In spiritual life, one must conduct one's whole life under the guidance of the guru. Only one who executes his spiritual life under the direction of the spiritual master can achieve the mercy of Krishna. Yasya prasadat bhagavat prasada. If one desires to advance in spiritual life, but he acts whimsically, not following the orders of the spiritual master, he has no shelter. Yasya prasadam nagati katopi. Without the spiritual master's order, even the grihastha should not indulge in sex life. So I'm going to read another two verses, because the schedule will go out of sync otherwise. It was meant to be Bhagavatam class, but it was only given a CC class. So I'll just read another couple of verses. Anjana bhyana janmarda striyavale kamisham madu shragandale palankarams tyajayurye brihadvrataha. Brahmacharis or grihasthas who have taken the vow of celibacy, as described above, should not indulge in the following: applying powder or ointment to the eyes, massaging the head with oil, massaging the body with the hands, seeing a woman or painting a woman's picture, eating meat, drinking wine, decorating the body with flower garlands, smearing scented ointment on the body, or decorating the body with ornaments. These they should give up. Ushit vaivam guru kule dvijo ditya vabudyacha trayim sango panishadam yavarartam yatabalam datvavaram anugyato guru kamam yadishvaraha griham vanam vapravishet pravrajet tatravavaset. According to the rules and regulations mentioned above, one who is twice born, namely a Brahmin, Kshatriya, or Vaishya, should reside in a gurukul under the care of the spiritual master. Then he should study and learn all the Vedic literatures, along with their supplements and the Upanishads, according to his ability and power to study. If possible, the student or disciple should reward the spiritual master with the remuneration the spiritual master requests, and then, following the master's order, the disciple should leave and accept one of the other ashrams, namely the Grihastha ashram, Vanaprastha ashram, or Sannyas ashram, as he desires. Purport. To study the Vedas and understand them, of course, requires some special intelligence. But the members of the three higher sections of society, namely the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, must learn the Vedic literatures according to their capability and power to understand. In other words, studying the Vedic literatures is compulsory for everyone but the Shudras and Antyajas. The Antyajas is the category below the Shudras, Chandalas, etc. The Vedic literature gives the knowledge that can lead one to understand the absolute truth, Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. Gurukul, or the reformatory education institution, should be used only to understand Vedic knowledge. At the present time, there are many educational institutions for training and technology. But such knowledge has nothing to do with understanding the absolute truth. Technology, therefore, is meant for the Shudras, whereas the Vedas are meant for the Dvijas. Consequently, this verse states, Dvijo ditya vabudya cha trayim sango panishadam. At the present time, in the age of Kali, practically everyone is a Shudra, and no one is a Dvija. Therefore, the condition of society has very much deteriorated. Another point to be observed from this verse is that from the Brahmachari ashram, one may accept the Sannyas ashram, Vanaprastha ashram, or Grihastha ashram. It is not compulsory for a Brahmachari to become a Grihastha, because the ultimate aim is to understand the absolute truth. Because the ultimate aim is to understand the absolute truth, there is no necessity of going through all the different ashrams. Thus, one may proceed to the Sannyas ashram directly from the Brahmachari ashram. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur accepted the Sannyas ashram directly from the Brahmachari ashram. In other words, His Divine Grace, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur, did not think it compulsory to accept the Grihastha ashram or Vanaprastha ashram. Om Ajnana Timrindasya Gyananjana Shalaka Chakshun Unmilita Minatasma Shigirve Namaha. I was born blinded by the darkness of ignorance, but my spiritual masters are opening my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge, and I therefore offer my humble obeisances unto them. Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Shrimati Shivaram Swaminita Namani. Namam Vishnu Padaya Krishna Upstaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swaminita Namani. Namaste Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pracharne Nirvishesha Shunyavari Bhaskachadeshtarne. Narayanam Namaskrita Naram Chabha Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Tato Jaya Madhirayat. Vande Shri Krishna Chaitanya Nityananda Sahodito Gurudaya Pushpanvanto Chitra Shanda Tamonido. Perfect Society for Spiritual Classes. We know that Varnashram system is meant to elevate one from basically animal life to human life, and on to devotee life, to becoming saintly, and to become transcendental. It's a system of elevating conditioned souls, of purifying conditioned souls. That's the purpose of the Varnashram system. So this is this chapter is going into some detail of that. The basic background of it is that we're all in this material world being influenced by the modes of material nature, being conditioned by these modes of material nature. And this tendency to enjoy and to control is practically irresistible to anyone but the pure devotee. It's said in different... Prabhupada said that for man, woman is the woman, and for woman, man is the woman. Has anyone heard Prabhupada say this? Meaning, woman, the word woman is being used in the symbolic sense of the enjoying principle. So, you know, a woman enjoys with a man, so the man is the woman for the woman, because the man is the enjoying principle for the woman. For the man, the woman is the woman, because the woman is the enjoying principle. So there's this tendency to enjoy, to want to enjoy, but the tendency is to enjoy, like we see animals are enjoying unrestrictedly, because they have no knowledge. They have no higher consciousness to understand any other higher purpose except what the modes are dictating to them, what their body is dictating to them. Their body is constituted of the modes and it's dictating to them. And so therefore, in the state of nature, it's a very brutal life. Some people are very sentimental and think, oh, I wouldn't mind being, you know, a cheetah in Africa. I can, you know, have that beautiful, elegant body, and I can track down an animal and chase it and kill it and eat it, live in the state of nature. They have this very, very sentimental notion of it. But if someone has a very objective perception, they see it's actually incredible suffering in the state of nature. Animals go through so much suffering. And really, we shouldn't be surprised, because the material world is a place of suffering. I recently heard a lecture of Radhana Swami, and he said, he was making this point emphatically, that the material world is constitutionally a place of suffering. You can't get around it. And then he said, even the happiness that people experience, they experience it upon the foundation of suffering. The foundation is there. And you may have some little sort of moments of happiness that are skipping along on the surface of this foundation, but the foundation of the material world is dukkhalayam ashashvatam, temporary place full of misery. And the reason why it's like this is because we're eternal and the material energy is temporary. Its constitution is temporary. Of course, it is also Krishna's energy, and it's got its eternal dimension, but it's mutable. It's always changing. But our soul is not changing. Our soul is constant and eternal. So there's this conflict that's that you can't get around. It's a kind of an ironic thing that you find some source of happiness and then you try and extract, you know, or you try and set it up so that this happiness can last. But it can't last longer than the soul. Material happiness can't last longer than the soul. So eventually, the separation comes about. You know, the happiness comes from this, you know, like in the mode of passion, it says in the Gita that when the senses meet the sense objects, then this is happiness in the mode of passion. And so, but, you know, where the soul within the body, who are experiencing through the senses, and the senses are temporary. So the relationship that the senses have with the sense objects are temporary. That's temporary. But the relationship we have with ourselves is not temporary. We are eternal. So however much energy you put into a temporary relationship, it's going to end in separation because the soul will outlast that relationship. And so that's the foundation of suffering. That is essentially the foundation of suffering. So whatever happiness you build on that, and people are, exploring a myriad number of ways to find happiness, and it's all doomed. It's all illusion, actually. In other words, it's not reality. The reality is our relationship with Krishna. The happiness we experience in our relationship with Krishna, that is reality. And that is not, and that is a permanent, eternal foundation of happiness, that relationship. But in the material world, the happiness is flawed, tragically flawed. There was one, I told Sadhu about this, the last time we went to Oxford, I met one chap, he was a mathematician. He was just standing, leaning against the shop, and he was just watching me. For about 10 minutes he'd been watching me. And, I'd sort of noticed him, because we Sankirtan devotees have got very good kind of 360-degree kind of perception, of what's going on around them. So I knew he was there watching me. I could feel it. But I just carried on working. And then at one point he goes, "Oh, no, you can't say that. You already said that 10 minutes ago," because I'd repeated one of my lines for stopping people. And he was actually being entertained, I think, because I was stopping people in all different ways. And then he said, "You already said that 10 minutes ago. You can't say that twice." And I said, "Yeah, but that second time I really meant it, And he goes, "Oh." So then I came over to talk to him, and he says, "What are you doing?" And then I started explaining to him, and he says, "Oh." I said, "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I'm a mathematician. I'm really into logic." I said, "Okay." And then he said, "I've got a question for you." He said, "You're a monk, so you might be able to answer this. What is the problem with illusion? What's wrong with illusion?" And I said, "Well, what's right about it?" And he said, "I quite enjoy illusion myself. It's like you can just explore things and it's not real, but you can just explore it. And you can sort of come and go as you like. And you go watch a movie, it's not real, but you can enjoy the movie." And he said, "So, I don't see any problem with illusion." I said, "Well, illusion is a perverted reflection of the reality. If you have no choice and you're in illusion, that's one issue. But if you have a choice, you should choose reality." But he was very stubborn, and he kept on sort of saying, making these quite ingenious arguments in support of illusion. And the only way I was able to kind of turn him a little bit, even though he didn't admit at the end that he was wrong, that there was anything wrong with illusion, the only way I was able to sort of swing it a bit was when I said to him, I said, "Are you a student or are you getting paid?" "So I'm getting paid. I'm doing research work in mathematics." I said, "Okay. Would you rather be paid in real money or illusory money?" And he started spluttering like that. And then I followed it up. And one of his friends had come to listen as well. So there were two of them there, and his friend was listening. I said, "Would you rather have real friends or would you rather have fake friends, friends who are hypocrites, who say they like you but they don't really like you? What would you rather have? Would you rather that your mother loved you or that she didn't really love you and, what would you rather, the real thing or the perverted reflection?" And then he says, And then he said, you know, I still think, you know, you can blah, blah, blah about illusion. But he took a book in the end and he gave a tenner. So then that was some kind of, that was a victory of sorts, even though he didn't admit it, you know, like philosophically admit that he was wrong. I thought later I should have brought up the point that there's two types of illusion. There's the illusion that's being perpetuated by Maha Maya, and there's the illusion of Yoga Maya, that the illusion in a material world is actually like a diseased condition. But there is this illusion in the spiritual world that is transcendental. I should have brought that in. He would have loved that, actually. He would have loved that point of view, but I never thought of it at the time. But in the spiritual world, there's illusion going on. Once Tamal Krishna Maharaj said that Krishna, he said, is he has unlimited knowledge. Unlimited knowledge, but he in the spiritual world, he places himself into a state of unlimited forgetfulness. That he actually forgets that he's God. He's not acting, he's forgotten. It's not an issue, you know. It's not that he's playing a role. He's just Krishna in the spiritual world, and everyone loves him. And he said he's unlimitedly knowledgeable and he's unlimitedly forgetful. Because he surrenders to Yoga Maya, that so he doesn't know how things are going to turn out either, because that makes it more exciting. It's all for the nourishment of the pastime. So that type of illusion is okay. But when we're caught in the material illusion of that we're the body, this is not okay. This is like being diseased. This is the soul's natural desire is for freedom, and you know, illusion and disease limit our freedom. It takes it away from us. Again, in one class I heard Tamal Krishna Maharaj say that we're captives of ignorance. We're being held captive. We're prisoners. We're bound. You know, some person's put in a jail. They don't like it. You know, you see, when an animal is caught in a net, they fight like mad. They don't like being caught in a net. No soul likes their freedom taken from them. Because the nature of the soul, the Krishna has given us free will. He's given us freedom. That's who we are. You know, uniquely individual, and we have our freedom. So no one likes that freedom taken from them, either subtly or grossly. You know, when an animal is fighting in a net, it's its natural instinct for freedom coming out. And material energy is binding. Prabhupada uses the word entangle. We get entangled in karma. This word entanglement, you know, when an animal is in a net, it's getting entangled. It's getting more and more entangled in the net, more and more bound. Karma is like that. Somewhere I read Prabhupada in a purport, I think in the Bhagavad Gita, something about the chain sequence of victimization. When we act, when we act for selfish purposes, it's a chain of reaction. There's a chain of reaction. Therefore, the question of free will and destiny comes into it. And some people say, "Well, we don't have free will." You know, once you commit a karmic act, then you get a reaction for that. And then you're going to get a reaction for that, and you'll get a reaction for that, and then the chain never ends, and you're sort of like bound forever. But it's not like that, because Krishna's in the heart, and Krishna comes in the form of his devotee, and there's the scriptures, and there's always Krishna knocking on the door trying to steer us towards the light. Turn us from the darkness to the light, to enlighten us. So, one interesting point is that in this second section that I read, where Prabhupada says, it really struck me where Prabhupada says in this purport, technology is meant for the Shudras. The Vedas are meant for the Dvijas. Technology is for the Shudras. What does that mean? Technology is for the Shudras, Vedas is for the Dvijas. Anyone like to sort of put forward a suggestion, what that could mean? What's Prabhupada meaning? Technology is for the Shudras, the Vedas are for the Dvijas. Yes? Okay. I think that's getting quite close. Yes? Anyone else? Yeah? That's also good, yes?
Also, to have technology, the factories work.
So indirectly, Shudras, it depends on Shudras, yeah. I'm tying up all these three answers, actually, because the way I looked at it was that for instance, when you read the Bhagavad Gita, that section about what is knowledge? What is actually, Veda means knowledge. What is knowledge? It's not talking about any sort of like technology, you know, scientific technology. It's not talking about statistics or data or formulas. It's the whole thing on section on knowledge is talking about how to develop good character. How to develop really good character and to, you know, it's saying amanitvam adam, to be humble, prideless, follow in the footsteps of the previous acharyas, to be steady, constant unalloyed devotion to me, to understand the evil of birth and death and old age and disease. These are all things, these are things to do with behavior and character and purifying your personality. That's what knowledge is about, and that's why the Brahmins are dealing with the Vedas, and you know, the Shudras are dealing with technology. They're dealing with the toys, with the mechanics of, you know, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, really. Because that's all that technology's really orientated towards in this day and age, is to facilitate eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. To facilitate identifying with the body and just getting more and more entangled and attached to the material world. And attachment is what covers the consciousness. That's what covers the avritam, is to cover the consciousness. It's just attachment. You know, when it says in the Gita, avritam gyanametina gyanino nitya varyana, enemy, kama rupena kontiya, it's lust. Lust, you know, that's just, it's with terminology here. Whether we call it lust or whether we call it attachment, the enjoying propensity, this is what covers the knowledge, covers the good character. The pure soul, covers the pure soul. There's one classic example, I'm sure you've all heard of it, about how attachment covers the knowledge, but it's worth retelling because it's a very dynamic example. When they want to catch monkeys probably the Vrindavan monkeys are too smart for this one, actually. But in Africa, you know, where they're not as kind of clued up, but what they do is they get a coconut and they just cut the top off so that the circumference is just enough room for them to squeeze their hand in. And then they put some of their favorite food of the monkey inside the coconut. So when the monkey squeezes his hand in and grabs the food, he can't pull it out of that hole while his hand is grabbing the food. He can't pull it out. And so they got the coconut tied with a string to a fixed, maybe a tree or something. So the coconut comes in, sees the food, puts his hand in, grabs it. And then the hunter just comes, walks, strolls along, you know, and grabs the monkey and puts the monkey in the bag. Because the monkey is so attached to that food that he doesn't think to let go of the food and take his hand out the same way he put the hand in and keep his freedom. So the attachment, this is the pitfall of attachment. You get so attached, it covers your intelligence. You can't see, you know, it says in the Bhagavatam, Kamasya nendriya prityo labo jivata yavataha jivasya tatva jigyasa nartayas cheha karmabhi. Because we're meant for self-realization, nothing else should be the goal of one's work. One should desire simply a healthy life or self-preservation. Self-preservation. Like on a gross level, that monkey, you know, didn't preserve itself. It ended up, you know, whatever, in a science laboratory or in a zoo or something, you know, miserable as anything. So self-preservation in the kind of wider sense means what is the self? The self isn't the body, it's the soul. To preserve your spiritual identity, self-preservation, because the goal of life is self-realization. Self-realization. Nothing else should be the goal of one's life. So that example with the monkey is very compelling. And I'll just, one last point, which was really brilliant. I've been listening a little bit to Radhanath Swami lately, finding him amazing, absolutely amazing. So he was saying one time how we have to become really charged up with Krishna consciousness. And we have to be very, very eager to make advancement. And, you know, he was saying this point about greed. You know, the price you pay for Krishna consciousness is the greed, is the desire. How much do you desire it? That's the price you pay in order to receive it. And he said, when you have really, really imbibed Krishna consciousness and you are got so much faith in your own identity as Krishna's servant and in Krishna's identity as being the Supreme Personality of God, when you have so much faith, he said, then you become unshakable. He says, if you don't have so much faith, then little things can shake you. But if you have a lot of faith, things don't shake you anymore. So he said, if you have 100 pounds, and then somebody comes and steals 99 pounds from you, you get shaken. You get shaken. He said, but if someone's got, you know, a couple of million pounds and somebody steals 99 pounds from them, it doesn't touch them. It doesn't make them blink. So he said, when someone's really Krishna conscious, these little kind of discrepancies that happen in life. There was one book called, it's a New Age book. The title of it was Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. Obviously everyone's read it. But don't sweat the small stuff. So when you're actually very Krishna conscious, you don't sweat the small stuff. You know, something happens, somebody say, you know, scratches your car or something. You don't go into a tiz because somebody scratched your car. You realize it's just a car, you know. It's just, I'm an eternal spirit soul. This is a little scratch on the car. How trivial. And you can be like that for a lot of things if you actually start to really get into this philosophy and chant your rounds nicely and follow the principles. So that's enough for me. Any comments, questions?